Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through 5 decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be 2 tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out. Only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com.
Hi, I'd like to start things off by giving a hearty thanks to each and every one of you who have contributed to this month's fundraiser, Hope for the Day, which is a nonprofit movement empowering the conversation on proactive suicide prevention and mental health education. If you're listening to this on the day this episode airs, this is the last day to donate to Hope for a Day via ChrisDeMakesADifference.com. But if you're tuning in anytime after the initial release date, you can always visit hftd.org to make a donation to this great organization. Now let's jump right into today's awesome episode. Hey, everybody. This week's episode features two guests, brothers AJ Popoff and Jeremy Popoff, lead vocalist and guitarist for the band Lit. And super stoked they picked their mega smash hit, My Own Worst Enemy, to discuss today. And, you know, this was such a massive song for these guys on their second record. And it was just really refreshing to hear how they're still excited to talk about it. They're not jaded. They know that this song has given them a over 2-decade a career in the business, and that's very cool. You know, we touched on how the song does not follow the typical verse chorus bridge outro chorus formula, and that's really a testament to the song not needing it. This is just a little pop masterpiece as far as I'm concerned. And the song was just everywhere in 1999. You couldn't escape it. If you were in an elevator at a restaurant, in a movie theater, on the radio, it was everywhere. And you know, I don't really get riff envy too much, but definitely something about this thing that I wish I wrote. For all that and much more, stay tuned.
Have you heard Chris DeMakes a podcast? Hey, hey, have you heard Chris DeMakes a podcast? Hey, hey, have you heard Chris DeMakes a podcast? Hey, hey, have you heard Chris DeMakes a podcast?
I remember, gosh, it's funny, the older you get, and you guys could probably relate, I don't know where the last 20 years went, but I remember this song when it came out like yesterday, and I kind of want to set it up here. You know, your first record as Lit came out, and I say as Lit because I know you guys had played in bands together prior to Lit, but your first record came out in April of 1997 called Tripping the Light Fantastic, and I had went back and listened to a couple songs from that record. I kind of wanted to get your vibe compared to that and the major label debut. When that record came out, it was only 2 years later that the single My Own Worst Enemy was released in March of 1999. So take us back to the writing of My Own Worst Enemy. Was it during the touring cycle for Tripping the Light Fantastic, or were you done touring for that record, done playing shows, and you were in writing mode for the new record, and that's when it was spawned?
I mean, some of it was written on tour for Tripping, and Enemy was one that was written post first record tour, when we were really we had this warehouse in Anaheim that we used to basically hang out and jam in, and it, you know, all our gear was there, and it was like a man cave before that was a thing, but it was basically our clubhouse, and we just spent, you know, probably 6 hours a night most nights a week, and we were just really gunning for writing new material, not really even knowing that there was even going to be a record deal or a single, you know?
Well, that's what I was going to ask. That's fascinating. So here you are writing for another record. And I believe, was the label RCA?
Yeah.
Yeah. When did RCA come along in the process?
Yeah. We had a Tripping the Light Fantastic was actually, I'm getting kind of messed up on my timeline right now.
It was a long time ago.
RCA actually passed on us twice. Yeah. And so the third time, the time that they said yes was the third go around. And, it was the demo had My Own Worst Enemy, Miserable, Four, and another one. I think maybe Happy.
Okay. Cause that's what I was going to ask. I was like, wait a second. So you got signed so they did hear some of these songs, at least in demo form.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they had heard others before too and had passed. And, so it was an interesting time. Cause we were like, you know, we felt good about that batch of songs. We thought we were onto something. And I say RCA passed. I mean, everybody passed. Everybody, uh-huh. Every major label passed on My Own Worst Enemy.
Well, you know, what I loved about the song, you know, there was, looking back now, and I'm a little more objective about it as the years have gone by, but, you know, the 90s, it was a weird time, and I have nothing against down-tuning and playing, you know, drop D or anything, but, you know, the 90s was just, you know, all about that, and then here was this song at rock radio, alternative radio at the time, they called it, that came out, and it's just this major key of E rock song. And I mean, it definitely caught my attention, you know, and it was a kind of a breath of fresh air.
That's cool. Yeah, it was a weird time. There was a lot of the, like you said, like the tune down, the Corns and the Limp Bizkits, and it was kind of like rap metal or rap rock was thriving. But I think there was also, it was like a time in music where I feel like it's kind of getting back to it a little bit, where genres were just, they were kind of all over the place. And there was songs like, you know, our song was competing on the charts against Eminem and like Fatboy Slim. And then not, you know, right around that same time, Sugar Ray, I think Every Morning was, you know, in the top 10. But yeah, I mean, it was amongst songs like, you know, Break Stuff and what was it,
sure.
Freak on the Leash or whatever the other song was that Korn had out at the time. So it was kind of a cool time for music, you know, where it was just a lot of open minds and a lot of new sounds, you know, coming out. And
like I said, when I it was, it's one of those songs to me that was immediately catchy. I heard it in the radio and I was just like, oh, this is different. You know, and it really harkened me back to when I grew up. I loved 80s pop and 80s rock. And I was like, man, I can grab a hold of this. And I got to ask Jeremy right now. I mean, that riff, that octave riff that floats from E flat to E up to the B to the A, that the riff of the song. I mean, when did you come up with that? Do you remember?
I mean, I remember the night that we, a lot of times stuff would just happen by accident in that warehouse. That warehouse we had, man, what a magical place that ended up being. Even though we felt almost trapped in it at the time, it was really a place of a lot of creativity. But I, you know, like most of the riffs on that record, and you know, even on Tripping, it would just start out. As I was kind of setting up my stuff, or I would just start kind of jamming around and, you know, I think at the time we were listening to a lot of classic rock, and I was really at the time trying to hone in on this simplicity thing. And you know, songs like Just a Girl, Devo, or like even Magic Man from Heart. You know, I was a big Swingers fan, the movie Swingers, and
right,
that scene when they pull up to the chick's trailer and it plays that ding 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 ding, and it's the Magic Man Heart song, you know. And I just at the time was really, I just remember being really into the simplicity of those riffs and was, you know, trying to come up with simple but hooky riffs and melodies that rubbed a lot too. So they were simple, but there was a lot of rubbing going on, you know?
Well, oh man, I am so glad you said that. I was just talking to my producer, Chris, right before you guys got on about that, you know, and sometimes you got to be careful with who you say this to, because it, you know, it could be looked at, I know you guys wouldn't think this, but as an insult as a songwriter, but you said simple. That I don't have riff envy too much, but man, I wish I wrote this riff. It is so freaking good. It is so catchy. It's just like the perfect riff. And sometimes the most simple songs, the most simple riffs are what works, you know? And if you start throwing in that fourth or fifth chord, man, it muddies everything up.
Well, not only that, you know, we've recently, have had discussions about this song. It was just recently certified double platinum.
Congratulations.
In America. Thanks. Thank you. But we didn't really have anything to do with it. The funny thing is that it's that double platinum status started tallying long after the song was a single, or, you know, 'cause it was never a single for sale. You know, you had to buy the whole record back in 99 if you liked Enemy. But after the, you know, invention of digital downloads and streams and all that kind of stuff, that's when officially that clock started ticking on it going double platinum. So it's kind of crazy. But since that happened, we've been, you know, talking about it. And I think one of the weirdest things about that song is, as a songwriter, we often really beat ourselves up and we really, you know, kind of, or beat our heads against the wall. And sometimes it's hard, you know, but I think sometimes the hard part comes from knowing too much and overthinking it. And when you actually take a look at My Own Worst Enemy, nothing rhymes. There's no pre-chorus. There's really not a solo, and there's no bridge.
Oh, we're going to get to all that in a second. It's funny you say that, because I got it all right here.
It kind of just breaks all the damn rules that we seem to follow as songwriters. And then we look at that and we go, well, wait a minute, it's the biggest song of our career. And like, how do we do that? How do we undo 20 years of learning how to do this?
I know. Yeah. And that's what's fascinating about this song. And like I said, we'll get there in a second. I just want to kind of touch on going back now. Now, AJ, do you remember hearing the riff and was the song, did you kind of have the whole song written, Jeremy, or did you guys kind of jam it as a band?
AJ had scribbled down. I'll let you tell the story, AJ, about the lyric thing, but the riff and the rhythm and kind of the vibe of the jam started. And then as we started to come up with the melodies and stuff, AJ had this scrap of paper that had a couple of lines written on it, and it just started to work and it just fell together. And the verses sort of just fell out of our mouths right there on the spot. The whole song was written in probably, I don't know, 20 minutes.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I think it's crazy. And I feel like this is always a story with someone's biggest song. It seems that it writes itself. And you know, that night, it was like all the other nights we hung. We probably rehearsed three or four nights a week, and just a lot of it was just hang time, you know, drinking beer and just talking about what we were going to do. But this, that song, you know, the riff came out and immediately turned into that groove, and then immediately started, you know, I started singing the melodies, like verse melodies and just things over the top. And I just remember at the time, we usually put sometimes lyrics would just come out like in a scat or whatever, just as we're riffing. But usually lyrics came last. We would hone in on the riff and on the melodies and get the song structure together. And then, you know, go back and find either cool titles or cool phrases or whatnot. And then, you know, usually it would be Jeremy and I would get together and kind of bang out, you know, the remainder of the lyrics together. But yeah, I had an old car with a broken fuel gauge, and I had to constantly write down whenever I pump gas, how many gallons I was putting in, and, you know, and then, so I knew that my car got about 8 miles to the gallon. So I knew when I was going to run out of gas. So I just had that little pad of paper right next to me, so I knew it was up, and I had jotted down while I was putting gas in one day. It's no surprise to me. I am my own worst enemy, because every now and then I kick the living shit out of me. And I was just like, you know, at first when you hear the song, it's an sort of a poppy, uplifting sort of feel to, you know, and we're like, well, do we want to go down the road of, you know, regret and in this whole, like, which could have been a darker song too.
Sure.
It just sort of worked with this feel, and it's crazy, man. It's just crazy that we're still talking about the song this many years later.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's funny, you know, a lot of guests, they always want to pick the, you know, and I get it from the artist standpoint. I always want to talk about my new songs, but it's glad that you know, I'm stoked you guys still embrace this, because it's what you built your career on, and everybody knows this song, which leads me to the next. I just want to touch on something we were talking a moment ago about radio. And you can't believe everything you read on the internet, but in researching this, I don't know if this is true. Maybe you guys could shed light. It says the song peaked at number 51 on the Billboard Hot 100 after only being moderately successful at first. 51 seems awful low on the charts, because, I mean, this song was everywhere in 99. Do you guys know anything about that?
Well, it was number one on rock radio for 11 weeks in a row, but pop radio, like the Hot 100, is, you know,
okay,
like, is top 40 basically. And we were, I mean, not to pat ourselves on the back, but, and I should say RCA, we didn't, it was such a summer smash, you know, across the formats except pop radio. Like New York Z100 was playing it, but Kiss FM in LA wouldn't play it because it was too hard and heavy. And so we, you know, it only got up to, like, it never cracked the top 40 at pop. But then 6 months later, you know, we sort of kicked the doors in and for bands like Blink and bands that came, you know, bands that had big pop rock hits actually on pop radio came probably 3 to 6 months after we had, you know, basically kicked our door down, you know, until we just gave up.
No, and you guys are really, you know, I have to tip of the hat to you on that one, because think of the bands that really came after you. There was the, you know, Sum 41s, the American Hi-Fis, the, you know, tons of bands that, you know, were in that pop rock, pop punk type sound. And prior to you guys, that was really, again, it was the Drop D, you know, Rage Against the Machines and that type of stuff. And this was definitely, to you know, coin my phrase again, it was a breath of fresh air at radio, I felt. When you guys were putting, and I always ask my guests this, and I want to know, did you, once the song was kind of coming together, you're in your practice space, did it stick out to you compared to the other tunes, or did you kind of love them all equally at that point?
I think it was just one of the batch for us. I think, I mean, I speak for myself, but I think we all kind of agree that every record we've put out has sort of just captured, you know, where we were as songwriters through the course of, you know, the year or the 6 months it took to write it, or, you know, sometimes quicker. But it's always, I think our stuff has always been a little all over the place, because we've just, our influences come from every direction. Having Jeremy and I having grown up on, you know, pop radio, our dad being a DJ, he, you know, at the time when he was a pop radio DJ, it was everything. It was from, you know, rock, Def Leppard to, Michael Jackson to, you know, it was just all over the place. So, you know, big songs were big songs, and we were exposed to all that. And we were exposed to a lot of big band stuff because of our grandfather. So as far as anything standing out more than the other song, to us, it was just, oh, I mean, like, one day we'll write something that sounds really right, heavy, and next day we'll write something, you know, that sounds like an 80s power ballad. So it didn't really, for me, stand out as like, oh, this is the one, you know.
We were actually a little bit self-conscious of My Own Worst Enemy in particular, because our buddy T-Bone, who now everyone knows him because he runs the House of Blues in Anaheim, so everyone that's touring has probably come in contact with him. But at the time, he was just our, you know, we grew up together, and he was always with us, and he actually lived with me, and he was kind of the fifth member of the band. He just didn't play anything, but he didn't really like it. And so, you know, so it was kind of weird, because we had this song and we all kind of thought it was pretty cool, but T-Bone didn't really dig it. So we didn't play it a couple of shows, and we just sort of,
And that's such a bum out when your bro doesn't like your tune, especially someone that's that close to the band. Cause you're like, what do you mean you don't like it, man?
Yeah. Like, what's wrong with it? It was, and it was funny, cause then we played a show. There was a club in Fullerton called Club 369. And it was kind of the Orange County, I mean, everyone from, I mean, Korn and I mean, tons of bands played there, but for us and for Zebrahead and for like even System of a Down, it was kind of our home stomping grounds. It was the club held 369 people. That's why they got that name. But we played a show with Zebrahead one night, and they had just gotten their deal, and we were like bastards, man, because they had got, you know, we were banging around for like 10 years and they were banging around for like two when they got their record deal. But I will never forget like being in the office at the end of the night, like settling up, you know, getting paid our $300 or whatever it was. And Justin and Ed from Zebrahead were like, dude, that new song you played, that's going to pay your mortgage one day. Like that's insane, you know? And I just remember that, you know, that was back in like mid 98 and thinking like, oh, that'd be nice, huh?
Oh, wow. That is cool. Well, someone else saw through it. And, you know, I've never had a guest, at least so far on the podcast, or a matter of fact, anybody I've talked to just about songwriting and other bands. And I've had this conversation a lot that's ever said, oh, yeah, we knew that was a smash. We knew that was a hit. You know, we're too close to our own stuff. I've never had a Less Than Jake song that I was like, that's definitely going to be a fan favorite. It just never happened. You know, you're always really close to all your songs. You put, at least most bands and most artists I know put everything they can into each one of their songs. So that's really interesting that those guys heard that. And which brings me to my next point. So at what point did you start shopping the demo? And you said you were still getting turned down by labels.
Yeah, well, we were pretty relentless. I mean, we were writing constantly, playing shows constantly, LA, Orange County. So we were at that stage, and in 98, there was always a show coming up and always a new song in the pipeline. And we were, you know, we had access to a couple of studios. So our manager also managed Steve Vai, and he had this great studio in his house in Hollywood. And we used that a few times. And I think, you know, EMI was our publisher at the time, and we had access to their studio in Hollywood. So once we were scraped up enough money to buy a reel of tape, you know, we would go in the studio and just lay down these songs. And, our manager would just follow up with, you know, that she was never stopped shopping. You know, it was every time we would have a new couple songs recorded, she was sending them out to everybody. And the other thing too is we were getting passed on by everybody, but everyone was at our shows because every show was sold out and it was a thing and everyone knew something was happening. But like, you know, Interscope and Geffen and just all these different, I just remember seeing the same A&R guys at our shows time after time after time. And, you know, and they saw the crowds that were coming were no longer just our buddies. It was, you know, when you're selling out 500-600 people, you know, consistently, you would think the common sense would be like, hey, there might be something to this. But,
well, the cool thing too, for, I think what was going on was in, you know, instead of our focus was so much on writing songs and working on our live show and all that stuff, that I think where some bands maybe got so caught up in, oh, we want to get signed. For us, it was, I guess, our development deal, which where some bands were getting in development deals, was just basically happening alongside of these labels coming out to shows and stuff. Whereas we were able to just focus so much on the live show and building our following that our plan all along was to just kind of try and outgrow where we were, outgrow our town to this extent of, all right, now we need to expand because we can't sell out the venue any more than it's sold out. Now we need to branch out. And that's where labels, the timing worked out just right. Cause I don't think we were ready before then, you know, to really, you know, be kicked out of the nest, you know, or let our wings, you know, expand. And so timing wise, it just happened the way it was supposed to for us, I think.
Yeah, you guys did the right thing. You know, you built up that regional following. You were consistently selling out, you know, all the places in your area. And at some point, the majors were going to have to pay attention, you know, because all those A&R dudes were hanging out at all, combing all the shows. And there was definitely something happening there. I'd like to get into the lyrics of this and kind of how you guys work together. I know that you know, Jeremy, of course, you play guitar and you wrote predominantly the bulk of this song. And AJ, did you exclusively work on the lyrics or do you ask for the other band members' input?
Well, I mean, I don't play guitar. I mean, I started out as a drummer, so I'm really like for me, I was a drummer that sang background vocals and really wanted to be a front man, but a songwriter at the same time. So I think for me, my strengths when it comes to songwriting has always been melody and lyrics. So I don't come up with riffs, but I come up with riffs with my mouth, with melody. You know what I mean? That to me is my way of, you know, when I'm thinking of songs, I'm, you know, kind of almost percussively. I think Jeremy mentioned something about, like, you know, we like to have melodies that rub, and I've always made it a point to sort of, if the rhythm of the guitar riff is going, da-na-da-da-da, then I'm like, I want to kind of go against it, like a little more of like a da-na-da-da-da-da,
kind of filling,
you know,
kind
of filling the holes. Totally. Yeah.
I got it.
But I remember we both, I mean, AJ had written out those couple lines on that scrap of gas paper, gas mileage paper. But then we just sort of, you know, we went back and forth and just kind of spit the words out. And it was very, in a weird way, yep, almost looking back now, I mean, that was, you know, shit, that was 22 years ago. And, but I just kind of scanning through the lyrics, I feel almost like those were almost placeholder lyrics at the time.
Because, oh, wow.
You know, because realistically it was the lyrics that we never went back and fixed. And maybe that's a good thing, you know?
No, it goes back to that spontaneity thing where you just, you know, lightning in a bottle. It was written in 15, 20 minutes. I want to talk about not only the lyrics we're going to get into, but the structure of the songs. We talked about that simplicity. And when I really got the guitar out this morning and I was going through this, I was like, oh my gosh, there's no bridge. Where's the bridge? So the beginning of the tune, we got that iconic guitar intro. It goes through for two measures. Then the band kicks in for two. And then we're in the first verse. Can we forget about the things I said when I was drunk? Didn't mean to call you that. I can't remember what was said and what you threw at me. Is this autobiographical, AJ? Or is this something that was just a story that you were kind of making up or set this one up?
Yeah, I mean, the majority of our lyrics, I think, and probably up until, you know, a couple records later, we always sort of, it was more storytelling, you know, and it's definitely something we were living and we still do live, you know, on certain nights or days, things get out of hand. But I mean, that was just something that we felt like this is just things that we've experienced and our friends have experienced. And it was, you know, just very simple, very to the point, filling up the melody with lyrics and just telling a story of what many mornings felt like, you know?
Right. And then from there, and yeah, anybody, male, female, young, old, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be relationship wise. You can relate to these three lines there, you know, didn't mean to call you that. I can't remember what was said and what you threw at me. That could be your dad.
I mean, you know, the thing that nowadays, all you have to do is just look at your, you know, look at your text messages and see what you sent out, you know, or look at what you posted on your Instagram story and it starts to piece everything back together. But, you know, 22 years ago, we used to have to call our buddies up and go, dude,
yeah,
what happened last night? Or how did I get home? Or,
you kids have no idea what it was like to black out without a smartphone. You don't know.
And it's what they say is what you say when you're drunk, actually, you probably did mean to say it, right?
Exactly. It's the truth serum. So now it gets into, this is kind of like the pre-chorus. So please tell me why. And then boom, it's into what is the chorus of the song, but this really isn't a chorus. It almost sounds like a pre-chorus, but at the same time, it's just so damn catchy. The car is in the front yard and I'm sleeping with my clothes on. Came in through the window last night and you're gone. And that's your chorus. And then it comes back into the reintro with the full band of that guitar riff again, before it hits the second verse. And, so again, was this just something you guys, or AJ, you were living, the car's in the front, you're sleeping with your clothes on, came through the window? Or again, was this kind of like, a kind of a play on where your life was and seeing friends do it? Was it, you know, still autobiographical or just kind of made up?
Well, I mean, and you know, we wrote, like Jeremy was saying too, like we were kind of like bouncing lines off each other. And these are, I don't think either of us actually ever woke up and had the car in the front yard, but
bet you
we lived in, I lived in a condo. So mine was, my car is in the parking space. Right. And how the hell did it get there?
It's gotcha. All just, you know, it's just backtracking the events of, you know, why I woke up and I know I fucked up, but like, mm-hmm. somebody please tell me what exactly, why did I end up like this today? And why is my chick gone? And why?
Like, well, and I talked about the first chorus because really this song's interesting because it goes to verse two after the reintro, and it's now you get the actual song title. It's no surprise to me. I am my own worst enemy because every now and again, I kick the living shit out of me, which is a great line. So descriptive, beating yourself up, own worst enemy. But this verse is almost like a chorus of how anthemic it is. I mean, I'm sure you guys saw that at your shows when you launch into this verse in particular with that line, my own worst enemy, and kick the living shit out of me, that the whole crowd was singing it as loud as what I'm calling the chorus.
Well, especially yeah. the next line, the still burning, is the part that the crowd sings. You know, we stopped the music there and the crowd sings still burning, please tell me why. And it's the first time we tried that, was maybe Woodstock, and we didn't know what was going to happen. We were like, hey, on that part, let's go gun gun still burning, gun gun, and we just tried it on TV in front of a worldwide audience, and it was like, it almost knocked us over, it was so loud.
That is very cool.
We've been doing it ever since.
I'll have to go back and check out that YouTube clip. That's interesting. And that line, what I'm calling kind of the pre-chorus before it sets up for the cars in the front yard part. The first time it's just, please tell me. Now it's still burning. It changes from that first lyric, which is neat. And again, I could see why that would be such a crowd favorite part.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX, and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.
Goes into the second chorus. And then I have a question mark here. I kind of put bridge. Well, kind of. It's just the reintro guitar part and the band riffing on that for another four measures before it comes back to chorus three. And it only says, please tell me why once. And then it goes into the cars in the front yard. And then you get another hook. You get the ah-hoos that come in. And I want to talk about that in a moment in context of your producer. I have a question about that. But then it goes,
I think I know what you're going to ask.
Right.
And the answer is yes.
then it goes into what I call a post chorus, because this is kind of another verse, but it's still in the chorus vibe. You know, it's no surprise to me. I am my own worst enemy. Because every now and then I kick the living shit out of me. Can we forget about the things I said when I was drunk? I didn't mean to call you that. And then we have that guitar outro, which is the same as the other times in the song for four measures. And then it ends on the A chord. It never resolves in E. Again, for a song structure, when I broke this down this morning, I was like, wow. Going back to Jeremy's point of like, you know, gosh, can we get back to writing a song like that? And it would, I don't know, it's almost impossible for me to think in terms of that simplistic. And I mean that with the highest regard.
No, I mean, it's a lost, we admit it constantly. I mean, we're, as we write, you know, even this week, last week, you know, we're always like, we stop ourselves sometimes and go, dude, we're overthinking this. You know, and yeah, I mean, it's, we had been a band for 10 years and we had put a record out. And before that we had, I mean, we were definitely not, no beginners by any means, but at the same time we were just very lucky to have not subscribed to like we just didn't claim to know the answers of what we were doing. We just were, we were having fun doing it. We were writing stuff that we loved and we were selling out shows. And at the time that was like, that was awesome. And we had almost, you know, we'd almost sort of given up a little bit on the whole record company thing. And we were like, well, let's just keep, we're, it's going well right now. It's like, we're bigger than ever locally at least. And we're writing songs that we think are better than ever. And that's all we can really, that's all we can really ask for. Well,
and that's probably the best thing you guys could have done, because, you know, at some point, you know, I've talked to bands about this and or read about it. I've read every rock biography there is out there where they just gave up. They just were like, this isn't going anywhere in their minds of getting signed and being on MTV and all that whole thing. And they get caught up in that. Whereas you guys were like, you know what? Look at what we're doing. And you guys, sounds like you were living in the moment. You're playing all these shows. You're playing with your friends. You got now people showing up to the show that just aren't your friends. And so, as I said earlier, someone was bound to take notice. Going back to the original demo, you're in recording it. It gets in the hands of RCA. You get signed. You guys had chosen, and I want to know, did the label or did you guys have a say in this, in producer Don Gilmore? And Don Gilmore, he has a pretty good resume here. Good Charlotte, Linkin Park, Sugar Ray, Avril Lavigne, Bullet for My Valentine, just to name a few. How did Don come into the picture?
I think what was it? He had done Eve 6, right? So label mates of ours.
Okay.
Yeah, they had Eve 6. Inside Out was a huge hit in 98. And RCA at the time was really not a great rock label. Other than Eve 6, they hadn't really had any success with rock. And so it was a little bit of a risk, I mean, a little bit of a gamble going with them. But because they weren't a very seasoned rock label, they were like, we need a producer. I know a guy, Don Gilmore, he did Eve 6, and we have Eve 6, and they're a rock band.
Right.
And, you know, not to take anything away from Don, but yeah, he, that was definitely an arranged marriage, because he was, you know, sort of in the camp already. Now, our next record to follow, the Atomic record, you know, we had courted guys like Dave Jordan and Bob Rock and a couple other guys, but we eventually called Don and felt the most comfortable with the idea of going with him. So we definitely chose him and picked him and leaned on him on the Atomic record. But on Place in the Sun, we were just really, it was just like, tell us where to be and press record. We're ready to go. You know?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, in terms of, you know, the producer, you know, do you remember how much the song changed with Don? I mean, was the song pretty much how it was, and he just basically got the sonics out of you guys and the performances out of you guys, or did he have anything to do with that ahoo part? There's the question.
No, we that was on the demo. The only thing different, really? The only difference, and we actually are going to release the demo next year, because we're there's talks of a documentary about the song, and one of the things, probably going to dissect it. We'll probably actually have to have you be in the documentary now that you've,
I would love helped. To,
but, the ahs were there, the repeating you know, the repeating verse thing, all the little guitar jangly things. The only thing different was, and you're going to trip out on this, but the first chorus didn't happen yet. It didn't happen until after the second verse. So after the first, Please tell me. It went back into that. And, you know, of course, major label land, they're like, oh, no.
You can't do that.
Good call. I think that's and definitely needed the chorus right there.
Yeah, you know, I like to shit on major labels as much as I can, but I think that was the right choice.
Well, Miserable, too, is one. That's the same thing that happened. That, you know, Miserable starts out with the intro, you know, the You Make Me Come. Just with the guitar, me and AJ just by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually flown in from the after the solo.
Interesting.
And it's that same little breakdown part, and we flew it to the beginning because the song used to just start with.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, learning
production notes for sure.
Right. And for those that don't remember, I meant to mention a bit ago, you know, literally Eve 6 and you guys kind of saved RCA. I mean, there was a joke in the 90s. It was a Recording Cemetery of America.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're just there was nothing happening. I mean, they were really a pop and dance label in the 80s. But that's really cool. And now.
Well, so Dave Grohl told us one time that the reason that the Foos signed with RCA was because they couldn't turn the radio on without hearing Lit.
That's
and they,
awesome.
And you know, Bruce Flohr was one of our A&R guys, and he was the one courting them. So they were like, well, hell.
Right. So now, of course, you guys have been you know, trudging in the clubs for a while. You've been doing your thing. First record came out. 2 years later, this record comes out. You're playing Woodstock. I mean, what was that like? You guys had paid your dues. I mean, this song just blew up. Like I said, it was everywhere. And of course, I'm going back on my notes, I'm reading about the Billboard. Of course, you guys mentioned modern rock radio. It had to be number one because, again, I was hearing this song everywhere. I'm sure it was all happening at a breakneck speed, but can you take us back? What was that like? You couldn't walk into a mall or turn on the radio without hearing the dang thing.
It did. It moved really fast because they were, you know, it was a machine that was, it's weird to see how fast, you know, the corporate world, like a major record company, how fast they can move when there's money to be made. And they, I feel like we made the video for that song immediately as well. So like we were experiencing all those things from radio to MTV exposure, like all that stuff was happening all at once. So for us, you know, when they talk about an overnight success, we were like the 10-year overnight success story because it was, you know, we started because we were getting so much play on MTV and video love that we started getting recognized fairly quickly because the video was funny and people were watching that too. So we didn't really, you know, in retrospect, I remind myself of this and I talk about it quite a bit to this day, is like, I wish I can go back to that first like month or two when that was actually happening at top speed and really like just soak in every single like hour of those days because we were just like, all right, here we go. We just kept looking forward. And
well, for those that don't know, I mean, you know, Less Than Jake has certainly had a great career, but we never had a single. We never had this type of thing. And I know at the height of our career, especially in England, which is our biggest market per capita, how many strings and how many ways I was getting pulled at one point. But this is next level. So when you talk about going back, AJ, and trying to enjoy that moment, I don't even know if you really could. You got managers, you got labels, we got a video shoot, we got this show, you got to be on a talk show late night with Letterman and, you know, Woodstock. I mean, it had to have been happening at a blinding pace.
Totally. I mean, it was moments like Woodstock that really, looking back, made all these things so worth it. Because all the filler in between that you're talking about, getting pulled in all the different directions, it made me miserable. I hated, you know, I hated doing interviews. I hated doing late night television. I hated doing, you know, the schedule, the itineraries, all that kind of shit. It stressed me out. So I was always just a big, like, nervous wreck. So by the time we hit stage, that's when I would just be like, oh, fuck yeah. Like, this is worth it. Especially when the crowds were growing because of all the other things. And you're like, okay, well, we're doing all these other things because look what it's creating, you know? And, but yeah, man, I don't miss all that in between stuff, but I do miss, that excitement of watching those crowds for the first time, you know, and having a first amphitheater show or a first festival and all those things. Like, I know you've experienced festivals and stuff too. It's just nothing like those.
Oh yeah, no. But just to have that, and I've seen you guys, and in fact, we did the Warped Tour cruise together a couple of years ago. Oh. And it's funny, you know, came coming from the punk scene in the 90s, there was, you know, and a lot of that Warped Tour crowd was the skate and punk crowd. But man, you know, back in the day, they probably wouldn't admit to liking Lit because you guys were on the radio. But man, when you guys would bust into this song on this boat, I thought that we were going to sink like the Titanic. The place went berserk.
Dude, every
damn person knew every lyric, you know.
That's awesome.
It was great. Wow,
thanks, man.
It was great to see, you know, and that's all about, that's everything about a hit song. It's like it was entrenched in people's lives. And going back again to 99, 2000, you could not escape this song. You couldn't.
Yeah, it's wild. It's wild. And it's crazy too. When you talk about the Warped Tour, I mean, I don't want to say we insisted on it, but we were telling our agent at the time, cause we were getting all these big offers for, you know, these big tours and all over the world. But we knew we had this hit that was happening and we felt like, hey man, you know, we didn't spend 10 years grinding this out in Orange County playing in front of the toughest. Cause you know, Southern California is like the arm, the folded arm capital of the world. And it's they're the toughest crowds to win over.
Of anywhere.
And that was our, you know, that's where we learned our, you know, so anywhere we went east of California was like gravy, because we, you know, it's like training in Denver when it's, you know, 120 degrees outside. You're like, there's no oxygen and it's hot as shit. So anywhere you go lower and cooler than that, you're like, oh, this is easy. But we insisted on doing the Warped Tour. I think we only were able to do it for 2.5 weeks because we were going on another tour. But we felt like we had to prove to that community that, like, that was our community too, and that we were really the epitome of do-it-yourselfers, and, you know, the ethic was the same. And it was fun. It was cool and fun that we did that. But it was, and looking back though, I think we should have just like kept going bigger. Right in the middle of a massive hit, we're like, we're going to rough it in parking lots, and we're going to trade beer for water, and we're going to skip showers, and we're just going to like live like prisoners.
It was a great experience. I thought, I mean, Warped Tour was some of the best times.
Oh, yeah.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, career-wise, it might have slowed us down a little bit.
No, yeah, and that's the thing. You know, Warped Tour has broke a lot of bands. Totally. You're not going to break out as a band and all of a sudden go on the Warped Tour, because usually Kevin couldn't afford those bands at that point. You know, that was the thing.
That year that we did it, Eminem was on it. And
that was 99, and we were on the whole thing that year. I remember you guys being out there.
I remember that too.
Dude, I remember, this is a funny story that I don't know if you remember this, Chris, but what year do you remember? I think it was 01 maybe. Do you remember doing the Weenie Roast? And was it 01 or
it was 03? And I remember seeing you in the middle of the crowd. And I talked about you on the episode with Roger, because I had my bass player Roger on, and we had a song with the lyric "My Own Worst Enemy" in it. And I remember saying something. I'm like, okay, here we are at the K-Rock Weenie Roast playing our song that K-Rock's playing, and I'm looking out, and you're the first person I see, and I'm like, well, yeah, we ripped off your lyric.
No, I'll never forget. I think if I had anybody with me, it was like I don't think I would have brought him, because he was probably only 2 years old then. But I was going through, like, you know, my first midlife crisis, and I just remember, like, I think I went by myself for some reason. And
you
looked
like you were alone. It was in a sea of chairs, because we went on at like 1:30 in the afternoon. You were probably about 50 yards out in the middle.
And I was literally just trying to like go unnoticed and slip into the show, watch a couple bands, go say hi to a couple people and get out of there. And I just remember you go, "Hey, check it out. It's the dude from Lit." And everyone, I'm like, "God, damn it."
I didn't know your name, but I saw your hair and I saw your beard and the rubber band. I'm like, you had an unmistakable look. And I'm like, there he is. We were a ball of nerves that day, man. There was so much hinging on K-Rock at that point, as you know. And they gave us the parking lot slot, you know, as people were filling in, and there you are sitting there. And I'm really, really glad you remember that, because I talked about it in the Roger episode. That's really funny.
That's funny.
But guys, you know, I want to just say before we wrap up here that you know, your candidness today, and just the fact of how humble you guys are about the song, and still, because I know 22 years ago, there's no way in hell you probably thought that you'd still be talking about this song at the level you are today. And you know, you appreciate what it's done for your career, and it still puts people in the building for you guys, and I think that's awesome.
Thanks, dude. Yeah, we appreciate that. Talking about it.
And I would love to be in that documentary. Just give me the call, and I'm there. And before we wrap up, I'd like you guys, if there's anything you'd like to plug with Lit, solo projects, anything in between, go for it.
I mean, obviously social media is the best way to, you know, check on what we're up to. And we have, you know, Lit Band. Litband.com is our website, where people that want to go get merch or buy records and whatnot, that's the best place to do that. But Jeremy and I also have Pop Off Brothers that we're going to be putting out more music in the future, in the near future probably. So that's something we'd like for people to check out. It's more country leaning. So if you hate country music, then you probably don't want to listen to it.
Right on. Yeah, no, I remember talking to you about that, Jeremy, recently about that project.
we kind of needed that outlet. And I mean, the last Lit record that came out a couple years ago was very country leaning. It was called These Are the Days. And as much as I love that record, I think it might have been confusing to the hardcore old Lit fans and even, you know, hardcore country fans. And so we were like, you know, we're not going to stop writing these types of songs, but if we do something separate from Lit, then we can have another avenue to explore those things. But then in doing that, it's now kind of launched AJ and I back into full-blown Lit mode circa, you know, turn of the century. And now we're writing and demoing these songs that sound very fresh and new, but are very reminiscent of what we were doing in 99, 2000, you know, 2001, that era. So we're excited. I mean, there's definitely going to be a new Lit record in 2021, and it will sound like an old record, but hopefully with some, you know, some fresh herbs and spices on there.
Fantastic. Well, sounds good. Thank you guys for taking the time today to be on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris.
Appreciate you. Right.
Hello out there. Yes, hello out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!
On.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered on Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's band is Lost in Society from Asbury Park, New Jersey. You can find their music on Spotify, and you can find them online at Instagram, Facebook, or go to lostinsociety.com. Here's a snippet of their track, We Want Change.
Shoot, never time to take the blame. We want change, we want change, yeah, we want change, we want fucking change.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Well, man, after making this podcast with you for all these episodes now, I think the main thing I'm taking away is I'm never spending more than 15 or 20 minutes on a song, because if you spend any more than that, it's not going to be a hit.
No, I know, right? And I believe them. I know of Less Than Jake songs that were written in, you know, 10, 15 minutes that are fan favorites. There's, you really can't explain it. There's something to be said about that spontaneity.
Right. And, you know, it's funny, too, is they mention it in the episode. And I know this is the fact so many times is you have these things that you consider when you're writing them throwaway lyrics or placeholder lyrics that in the end, if they were the first things that came into your mind, 90% of the time, it seems like those end up being the best things because they're just the things that flow the best. And, you know, you think, oh, I'm going to go back and I'm going to write these really profound lyrics or these. I'm going to write lyrics that haven't been sung before. And you know what? They don't sing as well. And the thing that came natural to you is the thing that's going to naturally flow into people's brains and off their tongues, you know?
I can't tell you how many placeholder lyrics on demos ended up on Less Than Jake Records, where yeah. You ended up writing a song around that.
Right.
Because it just, that catchphrase or that line was just too good to throw away. You'd, as you said, you'd try substituting different words and it just didn't have the same mojo.
Right. Dude, it was so fun. I loved AJ's story about how he had a notebook which was used to keep track of how much gas was still in his gas tank, and that's what he wrote the lyrics on. I mean, that is my favorite story from this episode. That's so good because, I don't know, probably now there's some app on your phone that when your gas gauge doesn't work on your car, and if that's not invented, Chris, we need to get that app made right now.
Yeah, take it on Shark Tank.
Yeah, a lot of us, there's still a lot of clunkers out there, so I'm sure that would come in handy, but that's really funny.
Yeah, no, they were, and I love the fact that these guys, and I mentioned in the episode, just how humble they are in the sense about the song, and they're still excited to talk about it all these years later, because you know they've been hammered with this in interviews, and of course the podcast, the theme's a little different. It's not really an interview. You just, we're really dissecting and getting into the nuts and bolts of these hit singles, and you know, they just they had a really good enthusiasm about it. That was refreshing, and I think that they know that the song, as I said, keeps people coming in the building, and they have legions of fans that this song is part of those memories, part of their lives.
Yeah, this song's pretty undeniable, because when it came out, you know, once again being that jaded little punk rock kid at the time, even you know, you kind of touched on this, that they were on MTV, they were on the radio nonstop, and if you're a punk rock kid, you might be like, nah, fuck that, I don't want to listen to that, that's on the radio and that's on MTV. But this song was undeniable. You couldn't, regardless of that, even being a snotty kid like I was at the time, I couldn't deny that this song was great, you know. And that's what's so cool, is when you can transcend even like that punk rock attitude about it. It's so good, man, that riff.
Well, and people don't care about that anymore. We talked about this before. They don't care what labels you're on anymore. It was such a big thing in the 90s, and there was certainly a thing back in the day. You know, Warped Tour had their niche, and you were punk rock and this and that, but you know, the proof was in the pudding. Like I said, when I saw these guys on the Warped Tour cruise in the middle of the ocean, when they launched into this song, everybody was singing every lyric. It was right. Just, it was undeniable. And it's like, yeah, you were listening to this back in the day. Yeah, I'm on to you.
It's pretty cool that there are songs that, like, you know, the kids at the time could like, and maybe their parents were hearing on the radio and they also liked it. And just, you know, it crosses that boundary, you know, and sometimes there's songs that are so cool that they cross over, you know. And you know, the 90s for me personally is like, yeah, I liked my Fat Rec bands and Lookout Records bands or whatever, but it was cool that my mom and I both liked the Gin Blossoms and Counting Crows, you know. So like, there, it's cool that you have those certain bands and artists that transcend any sort of pretension or anything like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of stuff, you know, and I was kind of still, you know, I was getting into, in the late 90s, I was, you know, getting into my late 20s, so I wasn't, you know, had that punker kid attitude, but still, there wasn't a lot on the radio that I was gravitating towards, and you know, I distinctly remember this song coming on the radio, and I loved it. I loved it, and I still do. I think it's just one of those, there's nothing perfect in the world, but as close as a perfect song can get, this is a pretty cool little pop masterpiece.
Yeah, it's pretty timeless sounding. I will say that there's a lot of things you can look back on, whether it's in our own bands or you can listen to other bands, that sound dated. And I know that this song definitely has the tones and style of the time, but I don't think the song itself sounds very dated. Like, I think if this song came out now, it could be just as popular.
No,
as
it only sounds dated because most people, including myself and you, we know when it was released. It's dated from a calendar standpoint,
right?
You know, the production and everything else. It's you know, it could be a current song, and that's testament to hit songs and great songs that are timeless
and great songwriting, man. That's what it comes down to, and that's what this podcast is all about.
It sure is. Chris, right now I'd like to take a moment to introduce a third Chris, as if we need another one, into the mix here for the wrap. This is Chris Miller, and he was the big contributor last month to ChrisToMakesADifference.com, which was our fundraiser for Gilda's Club. We were running a little low on donations, or so we thought, for that month, and we put a post out there on the Facebook group. Anybody could help out. The biggest contributor would be able to get here into the wrap with us. And it just so happens that I also know Mr. Chris Miller. Chris is from the Dallas, Texas area. Known him for a long time through a mutual friend of ours. And Chris, how are we doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here. We gave Chris about a week and a half ago, gave him the lit episode to listen to so that we could talk about it here. So glad to have you here, and would just like to kind of know your thoughts, what you thought was interesting about this episode.
Oh, you know, the greatest thing about this is when they were talking about the fact that they were jamming to classic rock in their studio space, kicking a little heart, you know, the Magic Man, You could definitely hear that influence in that riff. And I love the fact that they've taken classic rock and they brought it, you know, 20 years into the future. And now we're 20 years later listening to this again.
That's a great point. You know, I loved Lit when they first came out. I think I even made mention of it in the episode, just due to the fact that they were a breath of fresh air, that you could definitely tell they came from that 80s rock background. It didn't sound like a lot of the late 90s stuff that was, I don't know, for lack of a better word, a little more depressing. Lit was a little uplifting and was just great. And I loved the song from the minute that I heard it. Do you remember, and we're going back now to 1999, do you remember the first time you heard the song? Or
oh, yeah.
Whereabouts?
I definitely do. And it was so relatable to me, you know, when it came out. I think so many of us have had kind of that drunken night where you had to kind of think back and weren't quite sure what happened, but you knew it was memorable. And I think it just kind of transported me back to those memories of, you know, doing things maybe I shouldn't have been doing, but really enjoyed.
Yeah, I always think I'm so thankful that cell phone cameras weren't around in the 90s. I would have been in deep trouble.
Oh, that would have been very, very bad. Very bad.
I'm glad you picked up on that, you know, classic rock reference, because, again, this song definitely has all those components. And I made mention that the song, in some ways, anytime a song is just written from that, you know, I don't know, classic rock element, it's kind of timeless. I think the song, you could hear it today if it was recorded by a new band of today, and it wouldn't sound dated. The only reason the song sounds dated is we know when it was released.
Oh, yeah. We've been listening to it for how many years? And it was everywhere. And you couldn't get away from it, but not in a bad way.
Yeah. And it was interesting when we, and again, made mention of this in the episode, we did the Warped Tour cruise with Lit a couple years ago. And, you know, a lot of their songs. And they had a number of hits, but this was obviously the standout track. When they would play this, we were on this cruise in the middle of the, you know, Atlantic Ocean. When they would play this song, the boat would go berserk. Just that opening riff would happen, and just it was really cool to witness. Just that just goes you to show you the star power, so to speak, of having that enormous hit single. How it just translates decades later.
Yeah, I went back to the Woodstock clip, them doing the song live, and it was just crazy. The energy. Everything else, it makes all the work you guys put into this that much more worth it.
Yeah, that's cool that you brought that up. I went back myself after Jeremy and AJ had shared that and watched that video, and they talk about the part where the whole audience sings, and it just, you know, the hairs on your neck stand up. It's just one of those moments like, wow, you know, that's
it's killer.
That is so cool. Well, Chris, I just want to thank you so much for your contribution last month to Gilda's Club. You knocked us over our goal of what we wanted to get for the month. Thank you so much for your generosity. And dude, thank you for always being a friend.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me on, and keep it up. We love it.
Thank you so much.
Hey, it's always good to get another Chris on the show. Big thanks to Chris Miller. And also, everyone else who has contributed to ChrisToMakesADifference.com. There's been a lot of people that have contributed, and it's really awesome. And there's some pretty generous givers, such as Chris Miller and Chris Kellett and Dane Abbott and my good buddy Johnny Atskanish. These people have gone above and beyond and been really generous with their donations. But every donation is very generous, whether you can just give a buck or whether you can give $100. ChrisToMakesADifference.com. Today is the last day for hope for the day. As you said at the top of the podcast, Chris.
That's right. So go to ChrisToMakesADifference.com if you can spare anything for Hope for the Day. And after this episode airs anytime after November 30th, 2020, you can go straight to their site, hftd.org, and make a donation.
And if you're listening to this episode after November 30th, if it's December of 2020, then the new organization that we are raising funds for at ChrisToMakesADifference.com is the Keep a Breast Foundation, which is focused on breast cancer prevention and education. And that is a great organization as well, Chris.
Yeah, they're amazing. We've known the Keep Abreast folks less than Jake met them on the Warped Tour many years ago. My good friend Melanie Pierce, I talked to her the other day, and she put me in touch with the people that could help us out with the fundraiser this month. So again, Keep Abreast Foundation will be our fundraiser for the month of December. And speaking of the month of December, Chris, tons of stuff coming up. I'm going to be brief about this because I don't want to get too long-winded, but I'm playing some solo shows at the end of the month.
Playing some shows. Whoa.
That's right. I'm playing some solo shows. I usually do my usual three or four a year. Boy, I'm really, really taking it up a notch. But three shows again in 2020. These are all outdoor shows down in Florida. They're going to be outdoors. Everyone will be spread apart. Christmas night, I'll be in Punta Gorda at the Celtic Ray. It's a 21 plus up show. And by the way, all of these shows are free. There is no charge to come see me play with my good friend JT Turrett. On December 26th, this show starts at 9 p.m., 21 plus. This is at Guanabana's in Jupiter, Florida. And on Sunday the 27th, it is a late matinee show starting at 4 p.m. at the Tide House in Stuart, Florida. These are all free of charge. We hope to see you there. Got a book coming out on the 8th of this month called Blast from the Past. You can find that at chrisdemakesabook.com. As well as the new Less Than Jake album 3 days later. Silver Linings comes out on Friday, December 11th, and the Less Than Jake live stream. We're going to be performing live to kick off our record that night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can go to lessthanjake.com for tickets.
Man, you're going to be spreading all the holiday cheer.
I hope so. I'm trying my best, Chris. I like to, you know, December's a fun month. I want to be festive. And, you know, thanks to each and every one of you for tuning in this week. Thanks to all our contributors, and we will see you next week.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick. And usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work. But we talk about decidedly not so grown-up things like
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from a niche music podcast that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life. And then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers. Think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like The Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Mo, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon. Again.